You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Good morning and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Jeff Fowler, tech columnist here at the Washington Post. I am joined today by Adobe CEO Shantanu Narayen, here to talk about artificial intelligence and more. Mr. Narayen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on your show, Jeff.
So we have heard from hundreds of Washington Post readers and viewers today with burning questions for you. So I want to dig right into kind of maybe a pretty live one, the existential threat to companies like Adobe. So I've been using your software for creative people for almost 30 years. When generative artificial intelligence came along, is that just another feature for Adobe products, or is it the end of Adobe as we've known it?
Well, Jeff, as you know, Adobe for the last 40 years has continued to innovate with our mission being changing the world through digital experiences. We've always had a passion for using technology to enable people to tell their ideas. And every successive generation of technology has actually expanded the number of users who can use our products to tell their story. I believe generative AI is one such technology, and it allows us, frankly, to further democratize technology. I think to your point, it is going to be disruptive if we don't embrace it and we don't use it to, you know, enable us to build better products and attract a whole new set of customers. But I'm completely convinced that this will actually be an accelerant rather than just a disruption.
Okay, so you guys made a tool for AI creativity called Firefly, which I think we're gonna see a demonstration here on the screen of how it works, made by Adobe. My question for you is, how do you convince the creatives who buy your tools that you're not trying to replace them with AI? We're seeing AI do on screen things here that people used to have a lot of professional skills to do.
Well, a couple of thoughts, Jeff. I mean, the first thing is that, you know, we're always been about enabling people to be more productive and more creative. And I'm firmly convinced that the creatives who use artificial intelligence to take whatever idea they have in their brain and have that manifested on whatever media type that they want to use it for are going to replace potentially people who don't use AI and don't use technology. And Firefly for us was just a mechanism of saying, how do we make this available in an easy to use ideation, the concept of cards. And so, you know, we not only have it within our products like Photoshop and Illustrator, where we've integrated AI, but the fact that anybody with a web browser can go and tell us what's in their head and start the creative process, I believe that's magical.
So you would tell a young creative person that that they're not going to be replaced by AI, but if they don't learn to use it, they're in trouble?
I would tell young creatives today that if you want to be in the creative field, why not equip yourself with everything that's out there that enables you to be a better creative? You draw inspiration from other creatives. We have this creative community called Behance, and you know, the tens of millions of people who come there get inspired by others. Why not understand the breadth of what you can do with technology? Why not understand new mediums? Why not understand you know, the different places where people are going to consume your content? Information in this particular case is only going to allow you to be a better creative, to engage with whichever customer you want to engage. So I'm a firm believer in that a knowledge of what's out there can only be helpful rather than ignoring it.
A leadership question for you. Adobe has been a little bit slower to come out with these AI tools than OpenAI, Midjourney, and some others. How do you get the speed and timing right for sort of launching headfirst into this whole new vein of technology?
Well, Jeff, what was really important for us as we embarked on our AI journey was to first articulate what was important to Adobe and how we would represent the creative community. And what I mean by that is, when you think about what's happening in AI, there's clearly a lot of focus on what are the tools that people are using. You pointed out Firefly.com, where people can go in, enter a text prompt and get a creative output associated with that. And you mentioned others like DALL-E. The second thing that we really focused on was, what is the data that you're using to train these models? As you know, they're what are called foundation models in imaging. There will be foundation models in the future for video and animation and 3D. And then what's the data that people are going to be using to train it? And we took a very differentiated approach, as you know, Jeff. We said we're only going to train our models with data that we have license for. The other people chose to train it with data that they may or may not have had IP for. And so I hear you when you say maybe we were a little late, but we were actually considerably differentiated because we said that for the creatives, we're going to stand up for what is licensed content with which we train the models. The second thing that we had to do was not just make this accessible in a web browser, but also make it accessible in the tools that they loved. The innovation that we delivered in products like Photoshop with features like generative fill, one of the most widely adopted features in the multiple decades that Photoshop has been around, actually gives me a lot of pride. So I think we got it right in terms of thinking about data and in terms of creating our own foundation models and learning from it. But most important, in creating the interfaces that people have loved. And I think we've been really appreciated by the creative community for having this differentiated approach.
Yes, I used the Photoshop generative fill function to make my family Christmas card this year. I bet I'm not the only one out there who did that. While we're talking about the big picture here, I want to ask you a question from a reader named Perry in Massachusetts, who teaches undergrads. Perry says, I am constantly grappling with the question of what constitutes real art and whether it's fair to label AI art as real art. How do you answer that question for Perry and their students?
Well, I think, Jeff, this is an evolving phase. I think from my perspective, art is, you know, what the beholder, you know, looks at art as and what the creator of this art wants to communicate and convey. And so I think there's no question in my mind that, you know, a lot of the artists or creators of the last few decades perhaps saw other forms of art that inspired them, and then they went off and created their art. And so I think you're going to use AI to both inspire yourself in terms of what you want to create, as well as you're potentially going to look at, AI art and say, I want to create something like that, but I want to put my stamp on it. And so I think as a springboard, as an on-ramp to creativity, AI is absolutely a phenomenal, technology to use. I mean, I think most creatives today still fear the blank page. And if this can help them with their creative process, get it going, and then they can put their stamp on exactly what they're trying to communicate, I think it's a good thing. And in terms of how it's going to be received, I think one of the areas, and I'm sure we'll touch on that, is that being clear about the provenance of that content and being clear about, you know, where AI was used and where AI was not used, I think is also an area that we're pushing the industry on.
Okay, I want to shift our conversation to the dangers of AI and how much of a threat AI poses to our view of reality. Now, look, people have long been able to use Photoshop to try to lie or trick people into believing misinformation. What's different now with generative AI?
Well, I think to your point, the use of technology to communicate things has always also had unintended consequences where people have wondered about, is that, you know, art true or is that an art a fake thing? In fact, you know, I remember going to a retrospective at the Met, which talked about, and the show was titled Faking It Before Photoshop. And it actually showed how, you know, when there was only analog photography, how people actually combined pictures to make pictures that actually didn't happen. So, I mean, this has been an age-old problem. I think where generative AI, Jeff, is different is the ease at which people can create this content and, you know, the pace at which it can be created is going to dramatically expand. And so I think the important thing here that's incumbent on all of us who are creating tools for it, and they're distributing that content, including the Washington Post. And you know, we're pleased that you're also members of the Content Authenticity Initiative, is to actually specify how that piece of art was created, a history, so to speak, of what was happened. So I think it's the combination. Technology is going to accelerate it. It's going to, you know, both accelerate it in terms of the number of people as well as the pace at which this emerges. But that's a phenomenon in media that's actually been true for the last 10 years. I mean, think about the number of television stations that people had, or the amount of content, you know, that you could consume with social media sites like YouTube and TikTok. That has so dramatically exposed. This is going to perhaps cause another inflection point in the amount of content created.
How worried are you that AI will have a negative impact on the US elections this year? Is that an overplayed concern or an underplayed one?
Well, I think if you even zoom out a little bit, there's a staggering statistic, which I think it's like 40 or 50% of the world's population, you know, will be voting this year. And so you have elections, not just in the United States, but in, you know, a massive number of democracies all around the world. And I think to your point, there is going to be a lot of content that's being created where people will need to wonder whether that content was authentic or not. I think the challenge that we have and the opportunity that we have, it's not a technology issue. I think with what Adobe has done and what we have done in conjunction with our partners, the ability to know for a piece of content definitively, who created that piece of content, was AI involved, how was it altered along the way, that technology exists. The question is, how do you and I, Jeff, and the world train these consumers to want to look at that piece of content before determining whether that was real or not real? And so I think we are going to be flooded with more information. I'm really pleased to see how, you know, a lot of the tech companies have all bandied together to say we're going to jointly try and address it and make sure. The BBC yesterday had content credentials that they're now posting for all videos. And so I think it's the training of the consumer and wanting them to look at a piece of content and then ask the question, who created it and when it was created, that I think is the next step in that journey.
So how much should the onus be on the consumer, the user, the viewer of the image or the video be? How much should the onus be on them to interpret whether something is AI generated or authentic? For example, Adobe was selling AI generated images of the Israel-Gaza war, and the company responded saying the images were labeled as generative AI and were made available to license based on the requirement that they be labeled that way. But is that just proof that the general public is not adequately prepared to identify generative AI images versus originals? And why is it the responsibility of the consumer to do that?
Well, I think two specific things that you're talking about, Jeff. So let's unpack both. The first one is when people view a piece of content, whether it's an article that you read, whether it's an image that you're watching, whether it's a video that you're watching, what is the obligation of a consumer? And the consumer is not solely responsible for all obligations associated with trying to determine whether it's AI. I mean, certainly the distributors of that content, the creator of the content also has a role to play. But the consumer does have a role to play in that particular place as well, because they're the ones who are at the end of the day consuming the content and interpreting that in the way that they want. And so I think, you know, when you go to a website and you conduct commerce, you know, people were trained to say, you know, how do you look for a secure site so that before you put in your credit card, you know that it's a site that actually, you know, has the credentials associated with it. So I think there is some education and some responsibility for the consumer, but not solely. Everybody who produces content and distributes the content, the more a company like the Washington Post, you know, promotes this notion of content credentials and has, you know, whether it's a check mark or information about what it is, I think that education process will increase. I think the second thing that you said, let me, you know, address that. Adobe stock, you know, when you look at the stock market, there's actually editorial content and there's creative content. Adobe only offers creative content. We do not offer editorial content. And what people were doing were actually trying to pass off what was editorial content or actual events as creative. And so we have actually worked to moderate that content and remove that content. But this has nothing to do with, you know, the business that Adobe is in, because we are in the creative content. There are other companies that certainly are in the actual news content or editorial content. But I wanted to unpack that because these are two separate issues.
So Adobe is also building some guardrails into its products. For example, when you're using generative fill in Photoshop, there are certain phrases that if you type in, it will not generate that image. So this is kind of a new role for Photoshop, right? Before AI, there were no images that Photoshop wouldn't make for me. I could do whatever I wanted to. But now you're putting in these kinds of guardrails. What is your role in that, in the maker of this technology? And then how do you figure out where to set these ethical guardrails?
Well, you know, the company has always taken upon itself the understanding that, you know, while our mission is to change the world through digital experiences and to enable people to tell their story, our purpose is also thinking about technology to transform and the good that it can do and what are the unintended consequences. So we're no strangers, Jeff, to understanding what unintended consequences might be, and as appropriate, taking the leadership role to address that. I'll give you one example of that. I mean, people did try, as you can imagine, with Photoshop to create currencies and pass them off as real currency in the past too. So we're not completely new to this. We're very thoughtful. We have a team in place, and you know, it includes technologists, it includes people from the legal, it includes people from our community. And I think we've actually struck the right chord of understanding when you know, we allow the technology to do things and when we don't. I think in this particular case, what you're also talking about is the intellectual property and terms that people have that are copyrighted. And those are the ones that we are saying, you know, we don't have the right to create something for which is already a copyright term, and we don't have license to do that. So again, I think we're being very thoughtful, and it's something that our community has certainly appreciated us taking a leadership role in.
Another viewer question from Bernard in New York. Can a moral code be built into AI programs? Is it possible to develop a universal set of ethical guidelines for AI?
It's a, you know, these are such great questions, and we are in an evolving field, Bernard, which, you know, we're going to have to continue to evolve and understand it. I think we've created some principles right now. And certainly, you know, as we create these principles, it's principles that's guiding, you know, how we develop this technology, how much of that can be codified and then, you know, actually put in the model. And then how does that model also evolve with changing times? I think we're in the early innings, but it's something that I know the community at large, the tech community for the most part, is being very thoughtful about understanding, you know, how we have our principles, how we embed those principles in all the work that we do. And frankly, this is such an important thing, because when you think about the employees that we have at Adobe, they're passionate about having impact, but they're passionate about doing it in the right way. And so I think the fact that they see at Adobe a company that has this moral compass to do things the right way, and they have a voice, and that we have a debate, that's how this technology is going to all evolve.
So when you guys make choices, you are embedding certain values, certain ethics in your AI, in your models, in the way that you deploy them to the world. Now, there's a community of AI researchers who say they want to be able to test that and understand that and poke at its margins. And today, quite a large group of leading researchers published an open letter that you might have seen asking AI companies like Adobe to provide them legal and technical safe harbor to be able to investigate, probe these choices in your AI products. What's Adobe's view on that? What would you commit to independent researchers to allow them to do?
Well, first, from the research group that we have, we've also published a lot of the papers that we have created. So Adobe Research is an incredibly prolific organization, and sharing, you know, a lot of the technology developments through papers At conferences like SIGGRAPH is something that Adobe is well known for, and we will continue to share as appropriate advances in research through Adobe Research. I think as it relates to the enterprise end of the spectrum, the fact that we offer indemnification for our enterprise customers is another way in which we are being transparent with them about what went into the training data and how we can create custom models. I'm not completely familiar with the document that you're referring to, but I'm sure there's somebody at Adobe right now looking at it. And like we do with everything, we will respond in a thoughtful way about what parts of those are reasonable and Adobe will be transparent about. And I'm sure the team's looking at it.
Independent researchers, though, are different from your corporate customers. Independent researchers are people like academics, journalists, who are trying to understand how your systems work and what biases might be coded into them or what problems might emerge. And I think the fear of the community is that when they attempt to hook into your systems to test it, for example, keywords that generative fill in Photoshop might not allow to understand what the list of them is, that they might get sued by Adobe for doing so. Do you think that concern is legitimate among independent researchers? Don't we need that voice to that the independence to be able to have these society-wide conversations about AI?
Well, if you think about how this is going to evolve, Jeff, firstly, I mean, the prompts in Photoshop, both on Firefly.com and as part of Generative Fill, are wide open. So any independent researcher can actually use that. And if they find an area in which they find Adobe lacking, we can have a conversation around it. So there's nothing today that prevents those independent researchers from using our products to look at prompts. Where this evolves in terms of the technology is that, certainly through our custom models as well as through APIs or the programming interfaces where people can embed our technology into their programs, they will have even more ability to actually then poke at different surfaces and understand how that works. So I think this is an area where Adobe is going to provide more access rather than less access, because the flexibility that affords allows more people to do interesting use cases with the technology. And so I think where we are headed and where we are already is, in publishing a lot of our specs, in making sure that we stand by our work. And I think the use cases that you talked about today, any researcher can actually go and try it out. And if they have, some things that they've learned, we'd love to hear from them.
So I want to go back to our discussion about identifying deepfakes. So my role here at the Post is to be the advocate for the user of technology, for the folks who are encountering AI images in the real world. And I want to understand how we're going to be able to tell. What tools are going to be available to consumers to be able to sort through this new world of information where some things might be totally AI generated? Now, I know Adobe is pushing this idea of content credentials as a way to be able to identify the source of an image. But that, of course, works for the good guys. The good guys are going to want to put content credentials in to identify their sources or identify what's authentic. What are we going to do about the bad guys? I know there are researchers and companies that are increasingly trying to develop software to try to identify deepfake images or video or audio based on clues hidden in the files themselves. Is that an area that Adobe is exploring? Do you think those tools will ever be helpful?
Well, the interesting parallel in this entire evolution is when you eat something, how do you know what you're eating and what is the nutritional label associated with what you're really eating? And I think the industry saw this massive progress associated with a nutrition label associated with everything that you can eat. Certainly some people, look at that, other people don't, and they're going to eat whatever they want to. And so I think that nutrition label is a good learning for us in terms of every piece of content with content credentials has the ability to specify where it came from. To your point, Jeff, all the good people are going to use it. They're going to specify what those content credentials are. They're going to specify how they might be used. I think if we can continue to train other consumers to say, if I don't see that nutrition label, I should, consumer beware in terms of where that content is. So that's one step in terms of the evolution of how we can educate people. I think the second stage will be programmatically, how can we take an entire set of images and try and understand that? And again, the technology is evolving there, because the technology to hallucinate and create these images through AI is also expanding. And so I think we're going to find ourselves in this ever-increasing technology race of people using more technology to create these images, as well as to find out what the actual provenance of that is. And so, you know, but the good news is that more and more people are focused on both sides of it. I think for the viewers of your show, I think it's really important for them to understand this is not just about technology companies focused on the generative AI and the power of it, but also understanding exactly then how it was created, how it was changed, how can that be labeled, what are the rights associated with it, what are the downstream implications. And as long as we push the boundaries on both of them, I think society will benefit.
Do you think we will end up in a place where there's a website, let's call it isthisreal.com, made by Adobe or somebody else, where consumers can pop in a URL, upload a picture, and get a read on that question?
I think there are already websites that do that, to your point exactly. Upload it and tell me about the picture. So yeah, sure, they'll be there. The challenge, again, as I keep saying, is are the consumers going to, you know, do that at the pace at which they need to do that? But yes, I think they are already, you know, both experiments as well as alpha sites of places where you can upload it. And, you know, as part of the entire content credential initiative and CAI, we're going to also have tools and tips and techniques for people to understand how to programmatically, as well as on a picture-by-picture basis, do that.
Another reader question from Edward in Virginia. How should the government be helping assess and manage the risks posed by the combination of AI and disinformation? What role do you think they should play?
Well, I think governments all around the world are sensitized, Edward, to this particular issue. And I think, you know, Adobe, we've been working with the White House, and, you know, they've been extremely interested in ensuring that, you know, as it relates to the upcoming elections that you alluded to, as well as content that they are producing, you know, how does industry and government work together to do that? In the Europe, there's, you know, a different regulation. There's the AI Act happening there. There's, you know, something that Adobe has also done, which is called FAIR, you know, about what copyrights are. So I think there's a lot of activity that's happening. I know a lot of the consumers want answers right now, but I think for this emerging technology, it's actually the conversations and the interactions that are more important at this stage rather than the final answers. Just given where the technology is, it's nascent. But we are really pleased at Adobe with the amount of involvement and the amount of engagement and dialogue that's happening with governments all around the world. They're all slightly different, Jeff, in terms of, you know, what they think about data sovereignty, you know, what issue is most important to them, whether it's IP, whether it's, you know, deep fakes, et cetera. But the good news is they all have deep technologists in government who are also working on formulating with industry good responses to all these issues.
We are almost out of time, but I want to slip in one more question from the Post audience about copyright. Remember that teacher we mentioned before, their students, they mentioned that there was also a question from their students saying, they are afraid to share their work online with the fear that it will be stolen and used by AI models. What should this teacher tell their students? Should they be fearful of that their work itself or maybe their style will be absorbed by AI and they'll lose it?
Well, first, let me speak to Adobe. And I think, you know, we've been working on this FAIR Act, which is the Federal Anti-Impersonation Rights, which is, you know, how do we ensure that this creative IP is respected and recognized. So, you know, Adobe is working. But again, in some sense, I think for most of the creatives that I've had the pleasure of working, they love showing their work. They love exhibiting what they are doing. And they're entitled to the rights associated with when they exhibit this content. Anybody who looks at that content there needs to be a trust associated with how they're going to use it. So, you know, at the end of the day, while there has been, I think correctly, a lot of focus on potential bad actors, I think in all of these, and we are the beneficiaries of that from technology, good sense has prevailed, ethics has prevailed, trust has prevailed. And so, you know, we will get through this. We will get through this in a responsible way, and it'll both make people more productive, it'll make them more creative, and we will respect IP, perhaps in a different way than it was done, you know, when it was just a picture. But it will happen, and I'm confident that, you know, companies and governments will work together to have the right thing happen.
All right, we are just about out of time, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave it there. Adobe CEO Shantanu Narayen, thank you so very much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.